Our fourth case for this morning is Jane Doe against Galster and others, 1325-51. Mr. Olson.
May it please the court, I'm Jeff Olson representing Jane Doe, who's here as well today. When she was in seventh grade, Jane Doe was the victim of a campaign of student-on-student bullying that culminated in acts of criminal battery. She survived with just a case of post-traumatic stress disorder, but some students don't. The question facing the legal establishment in the country is whether these majestic civil rights laws that were crafted admittedly without these particular scenarios in mind can be part of the solution to this problem. Not a perfect solution, but part of a solution.
So, Mr. Olson, nobody among my colleagues, I think, has been saying would in any way minimize the seriousness of this problem. But there is a legal framework under which we are obliged to operate, and part of that legal framework requires a showing that the school district has actual knowledge of the harassment. And that, to be honest, is the part of your case that is of greatest concern to me anyway. So I would appreciate it if you could address what in the record shows, perhaps at which points in time, actual knowledge on the district's part.
Well, in sixth grade, when TM and I believe it was JQ were sometimes using words like bitch and whore, Ms. Doe was talking to her guidance counselor, Ms. Lakatos, about those problems and those interactions. In seventh grade, she was talking to Ms. Lakatos about the way the boys were talking to her, and she also wrote to Ms. Lakatos and said that she'd been harassed on the bus by people who were telling her, go back to Russia and you're a stupid Russian, and they might want you back there. Now, we know that I think we've got a good case on knowledge on the part of the district, because Ms. Lakatos was the point of contact, and she's the one that was getting enough information that a reasonable person would have done a further investigation.
But that's where I have the concern with your case, Mr. Olson. Davis tells us what we all know, which is that kids mistreat each other all the time, right? And we don't want to set a hair trigger for federal civil rights laws on these things. And I had understood Davis to require actual knowledge of harassment severe enough to deny access, not just knowledge to call for a reasonable investigation.
I don't think it says that.
Okay.
I think if you read it carefully, it says we have to have actual knowledge and we have to have severe and pervasive, but we don't have to have actual knowledge that it's severe and pervasive to trigger an investigation.
No. So what? So a child comes and says, unnamed people are telling me to go back to Russia and are calling me a stupid Russian. She doesn't identify them. You're saying that the federal civil rights laws require an investigation.
Well, I think, first of all, she did identify them. The names are redacted in our brief, but the names were in her note. Second, I think where that is combined with a report from her mother that the harassment she's experiencing is causing her grades to plummet and causing her to withdraw socially, yes, I think that's enough to trigger investigation. And I think I think the court could do some good here. I think the court could say,
our objective is not to do good. Our objective is to apply the law.
I think, fairly read, Davis means that a school district, that where a reasonable school district would conclude that further investigation is warranted, a district cannot escape liability by claiming lack of knowledge that harassment was severe and pervasive. Now, I don't think that's a hair trigger.
Can you direct us to portions of the opinion that support that inference?
I think it's the only way to read Davis, because if the district has to wait, if the district is permitted to wait until it has actual knowledge that the harassment has already done the damage, the district doesn't have an obligation to act before it can prevent the damage. And
well, but the question, I think, still gets back to what did the Supreme Court tell us this set of federal laws? It emerges from Title IX, it emerges primarily, really. And the court was trying to draw very plainly a balance between leaving the federal courts out of the business of micromanaging every disagreement in a middle school on the one hand, and on the other hand, recognizing that the entire learning experience, access to the program, if you will, for children who are the victims of discrimination of various kinds, harassment of various kinds, is at stake. And so that if the school district knows that something like that is going on, it, under the implied right of action for Title IX, is going to be responsible if it doesn't take appropriate actions. The rest of the claim isn't brought out. So the concern is, does Title IX really require investigation every time there's an instance of vicious name-calling between students? I mean, no one thinks this is a good thing. It's just, where's the remedy? Is it a Title IX remedy?
The law doesn't allow government officials to adopt the ostrich approach in prisons. It doesn't allow them to adopt the ostrich approach in the workplace. It would be so ironic if in the case of schools where the victim students are the least able to report on their tormentors' activities, the law were to allow the ostrich approach and let school district officials escape liability by saying, although we strongly suspected that there was more here than met the eyeball, we did nothing, and we got away with it because we didn't know for sure it was severe and pervasive. Thank you. I'll reserve for rebuttal.
Okay, that's fine. Mr. Schmeckpepper?
Good morning, Your Honor. Please the court. I represent the district. I will begin where you left off with Mr. Olson, because I believe Davis is very clear in its instruction that courts are not to second-guess educators' disciplinary decision, and also that educators retain the flexibility to impose discipline as long as it is not clearly unreasonable.
But here are two points I would appreciate your addressing. Sure. One of them is the one that Mr. Olson has been making, which is in many areas of the law, even up to and including criminal liability, the ostrich approach is taken to be the equivalent of knowledge. And if we're willing to put somebody in prison for that, then it seems to me it's at least worth thinking whether that equates to knowledge on the civil side. And the second thing is, I'm particularly interested in the period really, as of the end of the school year, after this vicious attack at the school track meet, when the police come to the school, everybody knows at that point that completely unacceptable attacks, this is beyond harassment, this is criminal behavior, but just, it's certainly severe and pervasive and everything else, harassment too. And the school, according to her allegations, jury might believe this or not, doesn't help over the summer, doesn't really set her fears to rest that she's not going to have to go back to school with these same boys who were her tormentors. And so I wonder if there's at least a period of time after which knowledge is clear, the severity of the behavior is clear, and the school falls down on the job.
Okay. First of all, your first concern about the ostrich approach. In the proceedings below, in the summary judgment proceeding, Doe, through her counsel, agreed with our proposed finding of fact that the district responded every time we were advised something had gone on between these two children. to this day.
Is there an adjective there? I mean, or an adverb, you know, responded sufficiently or made some kind of response, but not, I mean, in other words, I thought there was still some dispute between the parties about whether the response itself was adequate, which is a somewhat different issue.
As I understand the appellant's position, there is no claim that what we did was wrong. Their claim is we should have done more because a reasonable person, in other words, applying a negligence standard, which Davis expressly does not apply. Davis says it is based on what you objectively knew. To your second point, and I'm losing a chance to discuss whether sex or national origin was actually a motivation, what went on here. As the court said, this case is not about whether what these boys did was right. But why these boys did, and particularly TM, did what he did is critical in determining whether or not the plaintiffs even have a claim, as the magistrate judge found. But to your exact question, the district found out about the incident on the school grounds that afternoon, a Friday afternoon. They found out about the track meet incident and the incident when TM hit Doe in the mouth the following Monday. Within 12 days of the last day of school, so I don't have the dates at hand, but within 12 days, the principal recommended and the superintendent agreed that all three of these boys should be expelled from school. The family was told that by the principal in person. The family was told that two boys had withdrawn rather than face expulsion and the third had been expelled. The argument...
When were they told conclusively of that? Last piece of information?
Yes.
When? I mean, was
so
it...
That was after they had already moved, right?
No. I believe they got the last piece of information when they were notified, I believe, the day or the day following the expulsion, which happened in August, as I recall.
So most of the summer has gone on. I mean, I guess my impression, again, taking the facts in the light favorable to Doe, my impression from her brief was that there was a significant cloud of uncertainty over the family during the summer about what environment she was going to face if she went back to that same school. I mean, people don't move overnight usually. I mean, it takes some family planning normally. So if it was August, that would tend to support that idea.
I'm trying to recall the precise scope of the record on summary judgment, Your Honor, but Let me say, first of all, there was no evidence that there was any harassment or any problem following the last day of school. And there has never been a claim that the district's actions after the last day of school were inadequate or insufficient. The support the plaintiff cites for moving is in a footnote in their brief, is a letter written by Doe's father, in which he says, I have never been informed in writing, and that's a quote, as to the status of the three boys. And that is literally true. It is substantively untrue. There was no interference with her access to educational opportunity as a result of any sex or national origin harassment, which we did not respond to.
Counsel, I gather that you told us the principal told the family promptly that he was recommending expulsion, right?
Yes.
And at the risk of stating the obvious, the principal couldn't guarantee that that would be the outcome.
No.
Because the boys in question have their own rights.
Right.
Through state statutes and the federal constitution, for that matter, for
right.
due process before they can be expelled. Some uncertainty, I gather, is just inevitable in the time that it takes to provide due process to the, in this case, the boys who carried out these assaults.
Yes, although the two of the boys withdrew late June, or early July, and the family was informed of that. And also when the family was, there was a, again, I'm trying to remember the full scope of the formal record, but Doe and her father were in the school in the week or weeks leading up to the start of school in the fall before they moved. and saw one of the boys' names on a class list and was advised that they were no longer in school. I mean, seeing the name on a class list obviously created an understandable concern, but we're advised he's no longer in school. So there's never been, and I do not believe there can be, a legitimate question that once the district became aware of the nature and extent of the conduct of these boys, and remember, the boys, even though the juvenile proceedings, they were never charged with sexual harassment, sexual assault, it was battery. Mr. Olson was right. They committed a battery three times. But once the district found out that had occurred, they acted swiftly and decisively. What precedes that is what I believe is inherent in the stipulated fact in the proceedings below. That every time we were told these kids were interacting inappropriately, we took steps.
I'd like to go back to that period. So in the record, I see how they took the steps to move the lockers. I see how they took the steps to have the counselor speak to her. But there was some divergent information going to the counselor. Sometimes Doe would withdraw a statement, and then it would come back. But the one that I noticed never seemed to be followed up on was the statement by the three boys of the Russian slurs on the bus. They did talk to her, but they didn't follow up, it didn't seem to me, in the record, in any sanctionable way, to investigate, follow up with those three boys.
First of all, there is a real lack of clarity in the record. I believe that the statements on the bus were attributed to a boy who is not involved in the incidents in 2007-2008. He's one of the boys who they asked to have his records produced, and there's orders and whatnot on the record. But completely different young man on one occasion. The second time it occurs that the reference to Russian origin is made is in the 2007-2008 school year by TM as part of this mutual name-calling back and forth. So what the record reflects and what the magistrate judge dealt with is two, possibly three references to being Russian from at least two different children separated by a year or more. Now, I would suggest to you that this is precisely the area that Davis was talking about in terms of affording educators the opportunity to decide how to deal with these situations. They did respond to the references and name calling. I mean, Mrs. Hattos was counseling both of these children because of their behavior on a repetitive basis. So my time is up. If there are any other questions at this point?
Do you mind if I ask
one more?
I have one more question, and it's the question about how the district court ignored Doe's testimony in one place as being self-serving. And it was something about her statements and her intent. Did you think that was an appropriate conclusion? And if it wasn't, can you still support your position?
I don't believe the district court discounted Doe's testimony because it was self-serving. I saw that reference in plaintiff's brief. I went back through the decision. I find reference to an affidavit is self-serving or disregarded, but it's in the magistrate judge's discussion of the general standards applicable to motions for summary judgment. When I read the content of the decision, I see no instance where the judge certainly expressly says, I'm discounting her testimony. I see no place where it's implicit, and in fact, the magistrate judge relied on Doe's testimony that I had a crush on this boy in terms of it as really the foundation of her determination that their conduct was based on personal animus or personal conflict rather than a sex or race or national origin based comment. So I don't think that criticism of the magistrate judge has a foundation in her decision. I answered your question.
Yes, thank you.
Anything else?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Mr. Olson.
Yeah, I can address a couple of points that came up earlier in the record.
One was whether Ms. Doe gave the names of the three boys on the bus. That's covered in the note that's quoted at the bottom of page 17 of our brief. With the kids on the bus, redacted and redacted and redacted, teasing me about being adopted and being from Russia. They were saying, go back to Russia and Russians suck. And then she says, I wasn't lying about the kids on the bus. With respect to the knowledge that the Doe family had at the end of the summer when they had to make their decisions, we discussed that at pages 34 and 35 of our brief. Defendant Galster, the principal, does not know whether Mr. and Mrs. Doe were ever informed of what decision had been made at the superintendent level as to expulsion. He does not know whether they were ever informed that an expulsion hearing or hearings had been scheduled. And although he told them that one expulsion hearing had occurred, he could not tell them the result because he didn't know it himself. While it's true that JQ was expelled from the district in August, we point out at the top of page 35, the Doe family was not informed of this before they had to decide where Doe would attend school in the fall, as late as the Thursday or Friday before Labor Day. Doe's father was asking the district for a safety plan.
Are you saying that the federal law imposes, that these civil rights laws impose deadlines and communication obligations while the school district is also trying to address the rights, go through the due processes for expulsion of the other children?
No. The court was interested in these facts in Mr. Schmeckpepper's argument, and I just want to make sure the facts are available to the court to do with what it will.
Could I ask you, just very briefly, it's not unusual here, but Doe's story changed a lot in what she was telling Lakotas, her mother, and other people. And that doesn't that pose a real problem for school officials where, in essence, they've got inconsistent and unreliable information?
It is a real problem, and that's why we need sensitive professional educators to get on this, because it's more difficult than it might be in a situation where you're trying to figure out, you know, who slugged who in the Wisconsin Supreme Court. These kids are under all kinds of pressures to shade their story depending upon who they're talking to.
I understand she was also reluctant to name names. She didn't want to get kids in trouble. She didn't want to be a tattletale. I get that. But if we're talking about imposing federal liability on school officials for failing to sort those kinds of problems out, it's hard for me to reconcile that with Davis, frankly.
If the school officials say, we did our best according to our training and we came up dry, I've got no complaint with that. If they say, we did nothing and we buried the allegations of anti-Russian hazing in our later report about the incident, I've got a big problem with that. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Thanks as well to counsel for the district. And we will take the case under advisement.